اللهم لك الحمد كما ينبغي لجلال وجهك وعظيم سلطانك. سبحانك لا نحصي ثناء عليك أنت كما أثنيت على نفسك. اللهم لك الحمد قبل الرضا وبعد الرضا، ولك الحمد إذا رضيت. وصل اللهم وسلم على حبيبك سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه والتابعين، وبعد. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. When should I start? All right. First of all, I would wish to thank everyone for their presence this morning. And I wish to make this particular majlis as informal as possible. As informal as possible, لِأَنَّ الْعِلْمَ نَسَبٌ يَرْبُطُ بَيْنَ أَهْلِهِ. It shouldn't be a matter of one speaking down to the other, but I think let's rather regard it as a مُذَاكَرَ عِلْمِيَّة amongst people who consider themselves brothers, inshallah. The particular aspect of ilm that binds us together, there are several. One of them being that all or most of us share allegiance to a common madhab. And that is the madhab that we are here to speak about today, inshallah. I will divide my presentation to you into the following topics. First of all, the origin and the structure of the madhab. Structure of the madhab will thereafter lead to two important aspects of structure, which is figures within the madhab and the works that they produced. So a'lam and kutub. In order to understand the structure, we will gain an understanding of it through having a look at the figures responsible for the madhab and the contributions which they made in terms of specifically the works and the developments that they brought about. Thereafter, the madhab as it stands now in its legacy, in its literature, several aspects of it. The furu', the usul, and the qawa'id. These are three different aspects that we will have a look at. And thereafter, I was asked to speak specifically about the curriculum of our madrasa in Cape Town and how it could serve or is serving as a means for revival of التفقه على مذهب الإمام المطلبي الشافعي رضي الله عنه وارضاه. The madhab was conceived at a time when two specific regional, geographical schools of thought had crystallized. In the Hijaz, there was the school represented chiefly by Imam Malik and his teachers before him, and the Fuqaha Sabah of Medina, that particular school that descended from the Sahaba radiallahu anhum, were active in Medina Munawwara. Thereafter, their successors from amongst the Tabi'een, notably the seven, and thereafter, the Shuyukh of Imam Malik, eventually up to Imam Malik himself. Imam Malik being the most prominent representative of that particular school. That school exhibited certain characteristics. It had certain attributes which the other school, the other regional school of the time, the school of Iraq, did not have. The school of Iraq, in turn, had certain advantages which the school of Medina, of Hijaz, did not have. Imam Shafi, rahmatullahi alayhi, is born into this particular world where there has come about polarization of fiqh into these two areas. On the one hand, the school of Hijaz with its particular characteristics. On the other hand, the school of Iraq with its own characteristics. What set him apart from the others was that he was not restricted to any particular geographic location. He started his career in Makkah, Mukarrama, under the tutelage of people such as Muslim, Ibn Khalid, Az-Zanji, the student of Ibn Juraij, the student of Atta, the student of Ibn Abbas. That's his first line of tafaqquh. Thereafter, he goes to Medina Munawwara and studies with Imam Malik, rahimahullah. In that way, he gathers the ilm of Hijaz. In Makkah with Muslim ibn Khalid, thereafter with Sufyan ibn Uyayna and a number of other teachers. In Medina with Imam Malik, and in that particular stage, he is a faqih in the Hijazi mold, with all the attributes and with all the characteristics of the Hijazi fuqaha. Therefore, his madhab qadim, to a great extent, reflects the fiqh of Hijaz, to a great extent, mirrors the fiqh of Imam Malik, rahimahullah. But thereafter, he is not satisfied with the level of knowledge that he had acquired, and he moves to the new metropolis of Islam, which is Baghdad, where everybody moves more or less. He comes there in contact with Imam Muhammad ibn al-Hasan, the student of Imam Abu Hanifa rahimahullah. Initially, his activities in Baghdad are those of a defender of the Hijazi fiqh against the Iraqis. He enters Baghdad as a defender as an advocate, as a barrister for the Hijazi fiqh against the Iraqis. But being the fair-minded individual that he was, he came to discover that the Iraqis against whom he was conducting polemics, they have a fair amount of advantageous characteristics within their fiqh as well. He recognizes the fact that as there is khair in the madhab of Hijaz, there's a lot of khair in the madhab of Iraq as well. Eventually he set about doing what he was best known for, and what becomes the hallmark and the outstanding attribute and characteristic of his madhab, synthesis. He takes what is good within the Hijazi school, he merges it with what he finds to be good in the Iraqi school, and he develops eventually in Egypt for the last 4 years of his life, his final madhab, the Jadid madhab, which is a synthesis of what he finds to be good in either one. In addition to that, he takes an unprecedented step. Not only does he synthesize, but he also systemizes something. Up to that point in time, every mujtahid, be from the Sahaba radiallahu anhum, be from the Tabi'een, be from the generations thereafter, every mujtahid had some kind of systematic jurisprudence, legal theory, and a system of usul. But none of that had been systematically and comprehensively expressed yet. Everyone used to make ijtihad, all the mujtahideen used to make ijtihad, but the spirit and the letter of that particular system had not yet been expressed. At the behest of Imam Abdul Rahman ibn Mahdi, the muhaddith who's a student of Imam Malik, he initially writes the Risala, Qadima. The first Risala was written with a view to setting out a methodology that could be used by the muhaddithin and those upon the school of Hijaz in their polemics, in their munadharat with the school of Iraq. That was the reason why it was originally written. Abdul Rahman ibn Mahdi writes to him and complains of the fact that we who follow the Hijazi fiqh, we the muhaddithin, we can barely hold our own in debates against people on the other side, against the Hijazis. They used to say that kanat aqdiyatuna wa fi riwayatin aqfiyatuna fi yadi ashabi Abi Hanifa. The Hanafis were the people of Qadha. كانت أقضيتنا. Another way it says أقفيتنا, يعني القفا. The scruff of our necks were in the hands of the Ahnaf. We were at the mercy of the Hanafis. Until Imam Shafi'i came along, Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal was the one who said this. Until Imam Shafi'i came along, and he taught them something. He taught them a certain methodology. Imam Ahmad used to say that we did not know what is mutlaq and muqayyad and aam and khas and all of these things until Imam Shafi'i came. When he was busy with this, basically setting out the methodology for the muhaddithin, to teach them and to train them how to go about thinking systematically, codifying their fiqh systematically, and engaging in polemics systematically, Imam Muhammad ibn al-Hasan noticed this. And he used to see the muhaddithin, the Hijazis, once upon a time, they could barely answer in a debate. So he remarked, he said, لو تكلم أهل الحديث يوما لتكلموا بلسان هذا الفتى. If one day they should engage in debate as well, if it ever comes about that the muhaddithin develop the ability to engage in this kind of disputation, this kind of polemics, it will be in the tongue of this young man here. The book was originally written for polemical purposes. Like Imam Shafi'i, his original purpose of engaging the Hijazis was polemical, to engage them in debate and prove the superiority of one school over the other. Eventually he realized that is not the objective. The objective is not to engage in polemics and to debate. The objective is to synthesize and systematize. So moving to Iraq, Egypt in the end of his life, he sat down, took the Risala Qadima, and rewrote it again. In this case, not as a book of polemics, but as a systematized system, or a method of usul. This is the way that the faqih should go about in his ijtihad. That was, of course, the first comprehensive book. There were several. There might have been a number of other atomistic works speaking about specific aspects of usul, but a work which covers from the masadir of the sharia, from the hukum, right up to the end, ijma, qiyas, and ijtihad and taqlid and everything else. The Risala was the first to come onto the scene at that level. So this was his initial contribution. Fusion and synthesis between differing schools, and then giving system to something which up to that moment was amorphous. Imam Shafi'i rahmatullahi alayhi passes away and leaves his legacy behind. So another major contribution that he had also brought about was, he noticed something. He had noticed that In the manner in which both schools use hadith, both the Hijazi school and the Iraqi school, the manner in which they adduce hadith evidence, that is something that's left to be desired. If one looks today at, for the Hijazi school, let's look at the Muwatta of Imam Malik. For the Iraqi school, let's look at Kitab al-Athar of Imam Muhammad ibn al-Hasan. You will notice that the type of hadith that they use, they would use of all categories, marfu', mawquf, and even maqtu'. Yani riwayat that reach Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, aqwal of sahaba, even aqwal of tabi'een are readily adduced in all of these sources. In terms of the shurut of siha, you would find some ahadith are completely muttasil and sahih, some are not muttasil at all. You'll find them using the mursal hadith, you'll find them using the munqati' hadith as well. In this regard, Imam Shafi'i argues extensively in many of his books. He doesn't have only one or two books. Kitab al-Umm is not one book. It is a collection of various different books. Towards the end of Kitab al-Umm, there are a number of books in which Imam Shafi'i argues for the primacy of the marfu', muttasil, sahih hadith over everything else. If you look at hadith books that are contemporaneous to him and before him, you'll find that they include what? If you look at the Musannaf Abdul Razzaq, you'll find marfu'at, mawqufat, maqtu'at. You look at Malik's Muwatta, you look at Musannaf Ibn Abi Shayba. They span the entire spectrum of hadith that are to be found. And then suddenly, in between, you find Imam Shafi'i coming and arguing very vehemently for the primacy of the marfu', muttasil, sahih hadith, next to which he accords very little value to the mawquf hadith. The qawl sahabi in the final analysis of the madhab is not a hujjah. In the final it was something which Imam Shafi'i gradually changed his position on. In the last recension of the Risala, qawl sahabi still appears to be a hujjah with certain strings attached. But in the very, very final stages of the madhab, qawl sahabi is not regarded as a hujjah. Eventually that was overturned. And he argued for the primacy of the marfu hadith. So in Ikhtilaf Malik wa Shafi'i, which is one of the books of Kitab al-Umm, he argues against the concept of Amal Ahlul Madina. In Ar-Rad ala Muhammad ibn al-Hasan, he argues for the primacy of the marfu, muttasil hadith, not governed by any other criteria, but the normal criteria of siha. In Ar-Rad ala Siyar al-Awza'i, an interesting work, Siyar al-Awza'i, Imam Abu Hanifa rahimahullah had compiled certain masail on the issue of Siyar. What happened thereafter was that Imam Awza'i got hold of those masail, and he says that we are the people of the Thaghr. We live on the borders, we know jihad better than anyone else. So he responds and rebuts those masail of Imam Abu Hanifa rahimahullah. And Imam Abu Yusuf thereafter comes and responds to Awza'i. And that is called Ar-Rad ala Siyar al-Awza'i. Imam Shafi'i, the fourth from Abu Hanifa to Awza'i to Abu Yusuf to Imam Shafi'i rahimahullah, the fourth of these four mujtahideen takes the central position and then sits in muhakama, sits in judgment between these three mujtahideen in front of them, and sometimes sides with the one party, sometimes sides with the other party. But the entire thing is an exercise aimed at raising the marfu' muttasil hadith to the level of primacy. After Imam Shafi'i rahimahullah, he dies in the year 204. Within 50 years after his death, suddenly a new trend emerges in the writing of hadith books. In the writing of hadith books, you find who? You find, first of all, Imam Bukhari rahimahullah writing a book on hadith, only sahih and only marfu', followed by Imam Muslim, thereafter Abu Dawud, Tirmidhi, Ibn Majah. Nasa is the last of the six to die in 303. These six books emerge as the prime sources of hadith literature. There are many others before them, after them, even more. But these six books occupy pride of place. Why? Because a certain selection criterion has been applied, by and large, sahih, almost exclusively marfu', the mawquf hadith, the munqati' hadith, the maqtu' hadith, the mursal hadith generally doesn't feature as the prime material within these books. What led to this particular development? This is a theory. It's by no means a fact, but it's a theory. Imam Shafi'i rahimahullah argues extensively for the primacy of the marfu' hadith. Suddenly, within 50 years of his death, this trend starts. Imam Bukhari, if you go back to Imam Bukhari, who was the first of these writers, and we ask who was the one who influenced Imam Bukhari to go along these lines. There are several chains of transmission between Imam Bukhari, Imam Shafi'i. The very first teacher who he transmits from in the Sahih is Abdullah ibn Zubayr al-Humaydi, who was Imam Shafi'i's very close student. More Significantly though, Ishaq ibn Rahway. Ishaq ibn Rahway, together with Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, used to sit with Imam Shafi'i, discuss, have debates with him and everything else. In Tabaqat Shafi'iyya Kubra, Ibn Subki mentioned something of greater significance, and he says that when Ishaq came back to his home city of Marw, he did not have the books of Imam Shafi'i with him. Now, by that time, the books of Imam Shafi'i had spread far and wide. He did not have the books. There was a man in that city who used to have the books. That man passed away, and his widow was left with his books. Ishaq married that widow. They say Ishaq married her for no reason other than to get the books. Allahu A'lam. Sometime later, there was a great admirer of Imam Shafi'i, and he was Dawood ibn Ali al-Isbahani, better known as Dawood al-Zahiri. Dawood al-Zahiri came to visit Ishaq ibn Rahway once. And at this time, Ishaq ibn Rahway is busy compiling his own fiqh. He had his own madhab, like Ahmad had his own madhab and so on. So he's busy compiling his own fiqh. He's sitting in the one room, Dawood is sitting in the other room where the kitabs are. He's busy doing something private on the other side, and Dawood starts paging through the books. As he's paging through the books, he says, but I know these books. These are not your books, these are Imam Shafi'i's books. So Ishaq from the other side says, what are you doing? Leave those books alone. And Dawood replies that, what is the ayah from Surah Yusuf? How does the ayah go? Illa man wajadna mata'ana inna. SubhanAllah. The ayah is escaping my notice now. Who knows the ayah? The end of the ayah is... قَالَ مَعَاذَ اللَّهِ أَن نَأْخُذْ إِلَّا مَنْ وَجَدْنَا مَتَاعَنَا عِنْدَهِ. He says, this is not yours. This belongs to Imam Shafi'i. In any event, Ishaq is the person who remarks to Imam Bukhari that why doesn't one of you, speaking to the students there, why doesn't one of you take up the task of writing a book that will contain marfu' sahih ahadith? It's a theory, Allahu A'lam. But if you look at it, Imam Shafi'i's vehement argumentation in favor of the marfu' sahih hadith, thereafter followed almost within 50 years after his death by a trend that then stops at Imam Nasa'i rahmatullahi alayhi, and these six books rising to that particular place of eminence amongst the books of hadith till today. We speak about the Sihah Sitta. There is something to be said for it. How much truth there is in it? Well, that's a hypothesis that is, should be tested. So, after Imam Shafi rahmatullahi alayhi passes away, the year 204, the madhab still continues thereafter. The greatest achievement of the A'imma Arba'a has been their ability not just to compile fiqh, not just to systematically compile fiqh, but together with it inspire not one, but successive generations, not for 100 years, but for over 1,000 years to continue that tradition onwards. That has been the manner in which Allah Ta'ala has set the A'imma Arba'a apart from the others. There were so many different mujtahideen. Some speak of 15 and some speak of no specific number, but a large number of mujtahideen in the madhab. What happened to all of them? The madhahib, somehow or the other, came to an end. But with the A'imma Arba'a, Allah Ta'ala had made it such that they had preserved their madhahib. In which way? Through them inspiring one generation, that generation inspiring the other, and that particular staying power, that self-sustaining ability, continues up to the present day, where the four madhahib are continuing their chains of transmission, generation after the generation after our own time. What happens to the madhab hereafter is that the early fuqaha of the madhab, whom we call Ashabul Wujuh, they continue. They continue with the task of raising the edifice of the madhab upon the usul left by Imam Shafi'i, and in imitation of the furu' that he had developed himself. Those particular opinions that are added to the madhab after Imam Shafi'i's demise, and by those who we call the Ashabul Wujuh in the madhab, those are called wujuh. They are called wujuh in order to differentiate between them and the aqwal. Now, Imam Shafi'i rahmatullahi alayhi has various different aqwal. There's ikhtilaf within the aqwal at times. And the ikhtilaf within the Shafi'i madhab is easily understandable. Why is there ikhtilaf? Because he went through various different stages, and they can easily be pinpointed to either the earlier period or the later period. The general rule being, if there's ikhtilaf, then the later view takes precedence over the earlier view, except in a number of cases that are well known, some 15 to 20 cases. In any event, they continue the development further. Eventually the development starts in Egypt, but then it moves to Baghdad. In Egypt there is Muzani and Rabi' And the other students of Imam Shafi'i, they continue transmitting. The Iraqi students were there once upon a time as well. There were four transmitters of the Madhab Qadim. They were Hassan ibn Muhammad al-Za'farani, Hussein ibn Ali al-Karabisi, Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, and Imam Abu Thawr Ibrahim ibn Khalid al-Kalbi. These are the transmitters of the Qadim. It used to be thought that the book that contains the Qadim had been lost a long time ago. And it had not, early, probably in the 3rd, 4th century already had been lost. I thought that as well, until recently the publication of the Muhimmat of Imam Isnawi. He mentions in the Muqaddimah, he mentions about 17 pages just of the sources that he used. 17 pages of books that he used to compile this particular one. And he mentions that he had found a very, very old copy of Kitab al-Hujjah, which is the Qadim basically. He had found it, he had access to it. I don't think it exists any longer. But it did exist up to Isnawi's time, which is somewhere around the 7th, 8th century. Well, we continue. The Ashabul Wujud thereafter developed the fiqh. The madhab moves from Misr to Baghdad in the person of Abu al-Qasim al-Anmati. Abu al-Qasim al-Anmati and others like him take the madhab to Baghdad. At this stage, there are two different types of fuqaha of the madhab. There are those who are purely faqih. Faqih and all... Take a glass of water, perhaps. All that they would do is transmit the existing legacy. Very rarely would they add anything else to it. On the other hand, there was a different kind of faqih as well. The faqih who has his independence of mind, who has his own independent ijtihad, but has a relationship with the madhab all the same. We speak of them as the Muhammadun Arba'ah. Al-Muhammadun Al-Arba'ah would be Muhammad ibn Ishaq ibn Khuzaymah, Muhammad ibn Jarir al-Tabari, Muhammad ibn Ibrahim ibn al-Mundhir, and the name of the fourth one escapes me for this moment. Can anyone remember it? The four Muhammads. Ibn al-Mundhir, Ibn Khuzaymah, Ibn Jarir al-Tabari, and one other whose name does not want to reveal itself to me at this moment. Probably come back later sometime. The difference between Anmati on the one hand and the other four is that Anmati would purely transmit what there is. And very rarely, I found in my experience only one instance where he's developed something substantial. For the rest, he would just take what there is and transmit it. So there's preservation of the legacy plus development of that legacy further on. The Muhammadun Arba'ah, for 10 years, someone like Ibn Jarir Tabari remains in Baghdad, Yufti ala Madhabi Shafi'i. And thereafter, after 10 years of this kind of engagement, he then goes on his own. He has his own independent Madhab. Ibn Jarir Tabari has his own Madhab, which also died out with the passage of time. After Abu al-Qasim al-Anmati, his student Abu al-Abbas ibn Suraj takes over leadership of the madhab. Ibn Suraj is known in the madhab as al-Baz al-Ashhab. And he is the defender who eventually draws the perimeters of the madhab. To this moment, you're a faqih of the madhab. The madhab has certain characteristics, but there are no specific parameters to it. The main polemic at the time was between the Shafi'is and the Zahiris. Not so much the others, the Shafi'is and the Zahiris. Between Ibn Suraj on the one hand and Abu Bakr Ibn Dawud al-Zahiri. There were many, many munadharat because the Zahiris are kind of offshoot out of the Shafi'i madhab. Dawud Zahiri, it is said that this is usually ascribed to him, but subsequently in the usul of Jassas Razi, I think as the similar story is told, not ascribed to him, but some other Zahiri faqih. It is said that they asked him that, why did you abandon Qiyas? He said, I read Ibtal al-Istihsan of Imam Shafi'i, and the same reason it applies to Istihsan, I found that it applies to Qiyas as well, and therefore I abandoned it. So they grew out of the Shafi'i madhab and off they went. In any event, there was a polemic between these two. And then there was an internal polemic within the madhab as well. In Mukhtasar al-Muzani, Imam Muzani expresses his differences with Imam Shafi'i on a regular basis. He says, this is what my Ustad Imam Shafi'i said, and this is what I believe. Because he starts out the very book, the Mukhtasar, he starts out the book by saying that this is what I've gathered of the ilm of Imam Shafi'i, لِأُقَرِّبَهُ عَلَى مَنْ أَرَادَهُ مَعَ إِعْلَامِهِ نَهْيَهُ عَنْ تَقْلِيدِهِ وَتَقْلِيدِ غَيْرِهِ. The spirit that Imam Shafi'i instilled within his students was this, that take this ilm of mine, transmit it to others, but as long as that person has the level of ijtihad, which was prevalent in the Ashabul Wujuh of the Madhab early on, Imam Shafi'i insisted with them that maintain your independence of opinion, do not agree with me simply because I said so. So Muzani would constantly express his differences with Imam Shafi'i in line with what he believed to be the wasi of Imam Shafi'i. Ibn Suraj now says that where Muzani agrees with Imam Shafi'i, fine, no problem. But when he disagrees, فَهُوَ صَاحِبُ madhab. That's his own madhab, that's not to be counted as part of the madhab. He draws the parameters of the madhab. Initially between himself and the Zahiris as the offshoot, then with, between the madhab and Imam Muzani on the other hand. So the madhab now has its own, not just internal contents, but it also has its parameters. And the parameters would be, as far as the aqwal are concerned, only those that fall in line with what Imam Shafi'i had. Anyone uses his own ijtihad, he is entitled to it, but it will not necessarily form part of the madhab as such. These foundations being laid, the fuqaha, the ashabul wujuh continue. They develop the madhab further on, until eventually quite a large number of furu' had been generated. And these furu', within these furu', there's ikhtilaf. After Ibn Surayj, his student Abu Ishaq al-Marwazi, he takes over his teacher's position, teaching in the madhab of in the halqa of his teacher. But his students come from two distinct areas. His student comes from two distinct areas. Some of them are Iraqis, some of them are Khurasanis. Khurasan would be northeastern Iran and northwestern Afghanistan and the southern parts of Uzbekistan. That would be what Khurasan is, more or less. Some students come from there, and some students come from Iraq. Eventually, the Khurasanis would go back to Khurasan. The student of Abu Ishaq al-Marwazi, who goes back to Khurasan and starts off a school of Shafi'i fiqh in there, is called Abu Zayd al-Marwazi. Whereas in Hijaz, or not Hijaz, I'm sorry, in Baghdad, the leadership of the school is inherited after Abu Ishaq by his student Abu al-Qasim al-Daraki. So we have al-Qasim al-Daraki in Iraq, and we have Abu Zayd al-Marwazi in Khurasan, in the city of Marw, and its sister city of Nishapur. After Abu Zayd, his student Qaffal Marwazi lays the foundation of, or rather the foundations that his teacher had laid, he establishes that school firmly. The same is done in Iraq under the leadership of Abu Hamid al-Isfarayini. He is Shaykh al-Tariqah al-Iraqiyya, and Qaffal Marwazi is Shaykh al-Tariqah al-Khurasaniyya. The two tariqas have something in common, that they share the madhab. And both of them are engaged in developing the madhab further on. But each develops acumen in a particular regard. There are two things, I made mention of them before, I'll repeat them now. Preservation and development. Preservation, in other words, what has been transmitted, just to continue transmitting it. And what has not yet been transmitted, new masail as they would develop, new questions as they would come up, as they develop, answers are needed to them. So one is riwayah of what is before, one is tafri' and takhrij of new masail. The Khurasanis develop a very good ability in new developments. And the Iraqis are very good at preserving the legacy as is. Both parties engage in both activities. It's just that the one is stronger than the other in department A and vice versa. The other one is stronger in department B. By the middle of the 5th century, we now more or less the year 450, somewhere around there, what happens is that the ancient world was an agrarian world, meaning that your economy is structured around the agriculture. It's produced from the farm to the market where you sell it, and that's where the economy more or less finds a home for itself. That's where the economy is based. You did not have an industrialized economy, therefore life is not as complicated and as sophisticated as it is today. So after 400 years of generating of furu', answers to questions that this particular world can throw up, you find a fairly comprehensive set of furu' had been developed for that world now. Now something else was needed. What was needed now is that certain authors come to the fore and take everything that had been written in all these various works of the Khurasanis, all the various works of the Iraqis. We needed systematic and holistic, comprehensive compilation of it all into one source. We needed that to be done so that there should be no missing masail any longer. They needed to be reduced into one particular source. This task is taken up for the Iraqis by Abu Ishaq al-Shirazi in his various books, the shorter book being the Tanbih, the longer book being the Muhadhab. In Khurasan, a similar venture takes place by Imam al-Haramain. Imam al-Haramain writes a commentary of Mukhtasar al-Muzani. By the way, during these first centuries, Mukhtasar al-Muzani was probably the secret of the success of the Shafi'i madhab. The secret of success, Muzani managed to take Imam Shafi'i's ilm and reduce it into a compendium. The moment it was reduced into a compendium that people can memorize, students can study within a short period of time, teachers can teach, then the foundation was laid for the longevity of the madhab there, from there onwards. The method was so successful that others started copying the same. Muzani's nephew, Tahawi, wrote a mukhtasar for the Hanafi madhab, and from there it continued onwards. Ibn Abdul Hakam in the Maliki madhab studied with Imam Shafi as well, continued in his Maliki madhab, and he wrote a mukhtasar for the Maliki madhab as well. The Hanbali madhab up to that moment did not quite have even a structure of fiqh. It would take some time later, after the mihna of Imam Ahmad. Imam Ahmad, his status simply rose phenomenally in the eyes of the public, and he was his views, his furu was, were made into a madhab. It would take some time before Al-Khiraqi would then eventually write a mukhtasar. So each of these madhahib, the mukhtasar was the secret of his success. Okay, that would be a bit of an overstatement. Secret of the success, I think the real secret of Imam Shafi'i's success should be seen somewhere else. In terms of the asbab of this dunya, we speak perhaps of the mukhtasar. Someone was asked, however, he says that I see two persons, two faqis coexisting at the same time. The one, within 100 years of his death, his madhab spreads from east to west. The other, great faqih as well, great qadi of his time, but his name is lost. The one is Muhammad ibn Idris al-Shafi'i, his madhab has spread. The other one is al-Qadi Yahya ibn Aktham. His name is barely known except to specialists. And they ask the question, what would be the reason for this? And the answer is that, in all probability, it's not that mukhtasar or anything, but it is an attitude that Imam Shafi'i had. He used to say, rahimahullah, وَدِدْتُ أَنَّ النَّاسَ أَخَذُوا هَذَا الْعِلْمَ عَنِّي ثُمَّ لَا يَنْسِبُونَ إِلَيَّ حَرْفًا مِّنْهُ. My intention is that I hope, I wish that people could take this ilm from me and not ascribe a single letter of it to me. The ilm should spread. Who takes the credit is not, it was none of his concern. It did not concern him at all. All that concerned him was that ilm must spread and people should know their deen. If there was a real secret of the success of this particular madhab and the other madhab as well, I think it goes, it can be taken down to the ikhlas that the imma had in the endeavors that they presented to the ummah. Abu Ishaq Ash-Shirazi writes for the Khurasaniyin. Imam al-Haramain writes for the Abu Ishaq writes for the Iraqiyin. Imam al-Haramain writes his Nihayatul Matlab, is a sharh of Mukhtasar al-Muzani. It was published about 2 years ago or so. And by the way, its publication is a major feat. I remember as a student, almost how long ago? 20 years ago to the day. Almost 20 years ago to the day. 20 years ago as a student in Egypt, I read a book by the late Dr. Abdul Azim Ad-Deeb. Much of his research was around Imam al-Haramain. He wrote a book on the fiqh of Imam al-Haramain, and then he edited Imam al-Haramain's other book called Ghiyathul Umam fil Tiyathil Dhulam, generally known as Ghiyathi. I saw this book and I noticed that he says that I am busy with the tahqiq of Nihayatul Matlab and inshallah I should soon bring it out. By that time he was 5 years busy with it already. It took another 20 years for him to bring that book out. It just came out about 2-3 years ago, and very soon after his publication, Dr. Abdul Azim Ad-Deeb passed away as well. And it's an excellent piece of work in terms of tahqiq. Anyway, this book was the comprehensive compilation of the views within the madhab as far as the Khurasanis are concerned. There was one thing missing though. But before I come to the one thing missing, Imam al-Haramain's student was Imam Ghazali. He looked at his teacher's book, he said, there's some work for me to be done. There's some work for me to do. He takes the nihaya of Imam al-Haramain and abridges it into a book which he initially calls the Basit. And then he takes the Basit and abridges it once again, and he calls it the Wasit. And he abridges it even a third time, and he calls it the Wajiz. So for the Khurasanis, from Nihaya to Basit to Wasit to the Wajiz, these are the books that comprehensively cover the range of the madhab. There are Mukhtasarat, there are Mutawwalat, and there are some in-between ones as well. The thing that is missing in both these books, both these sets of books, the Khurasani's books as well as the Iraqi's books, is one thing that's missing. They mention the differences. They mention on this Masala Imam Shafi has two qawls. They mention that in this, on that particular point, they are the Ashabul Wujuh have differing opinions, but they do not say which one is the rajih of the two. And the reason why that is so is that who needs the rajih? Who needs to be shown tarjih? The mufti or the qadi? The mufti who's going to give fatwa on the book, or the qadi who's going to pass judgment on the book? And during those days, the Mufti or the Qadi generally had the ability of his own independent tarjih. No one needed to point it out to him. It was a time when Ijtihad fil Madhab was alive to a certain degree. But then came the recognition that Ijtihad fil Madhab is also dying out. And very soon a time will come when the Qadi and the Mufti will be perplexed when he sits with that book in front of him, and then he has to figure out which of the two do I give tarjih to. That task Allah Ta'ala had kept for two other fuqaha of the Madhab, the first of them being Imam Abu al-Qasim al-Rafi'i. Imam Rafi'i takes the books of Imam Ghazali. He takes the wajiz of Imam Ghazali and he writes two commentaries on it. The larger commentary called Al-Aziz, Sharh al-Wajiz, generally called Fath al-Aziz, more commonly called Al-Sharh al-Kabir. He writes a sharh on it unlike any other sharh ever written before in the Madhab. And in there he goes to great lengths to pinpoint which is the rajih in the Madhab. Then he writes a mukhtasar thereafter. The mukhtasar is called Al-Muharrar. And also iltazama fihi al-tarjih wa-tasheeh. He makes a point of indicating that there are two views, this is the rajih of the two. He dies around the year 621. By the time that he dies, another faqih of the Madhab is born already, and that's Imam Abu Yahya, Abu Zakariya, Yahya ibn Sharaf, al-Nawawi. Imam Nawawi, rahimahullah, is the second sahib al-tarjih in the Madhab, and his opinions, or rather, where he differs with Imam Rafi'i, it'll take precedence over Imam Rafi'i's views. He takes Rafi'i's books and adds his own contribution to it. For example, he takes the Sharh Kabir and he reduces it into what is known today as Rawdah al-Talibin. In Rawdah, what Imam Nawawi does, he does not deal with Adilla. He does not deal with Khilaf between the Madahib. All that he deals with is Khilaf within the Madhab. Only Khilaf within the Madhab. On this Masala, there are so many Aqwal, this is the Rajih. On that Masala, there are so many Wujuh, this is the Rajih. Then he takes the Muharrar of Imam Rafi'i and he abridges it and adds to it. He abridges it, rearranges it, and adds to it, and he calls it Minhajul Talibin wa Umdatul Muftin. Again, he says, systematically, I'll point out which is the rajih of the two. He adopts a particular istilah. Istilahun la yastaghni an ma'rifatihi ayyu faqihin shafi'i. When it is spoken about the asah in the sahih, and the adhar in the mashhur, every shafi'i faqih should really know what Imam Nawawi rahimahullah is speaking about here. That is probably one of the most central mutun to the madhab ever, the minhaj. And iftah in the latter period of the madhab is based upon the shuruh of the minhaj, which we will come to in due time. He doesn't restrict himself to those particular works of Rafi'i alone. He goes to the books of the Iraqis as well. And the one book of the Iraqis to which he pays a lot of attention, the two books were the Tanbih of Abu Ishaq al-Shirazi as well as Muhadhab. He takes the Tanbih, one of his early works was Tasheeh al-Tanbih, in which he points out Tasheeh again. He points out the Rajih of the two. Since we're on to this point, at times what happens in certain places where they want to introduce Shafi'i fiqh, then at times they introduce a book such as the Tanbih. Not a very good step. Not a very good step, because you're back to the age before Nawawi and Rafi'i when there was no tarjih done. And it's important for a faqih today, especially in view of the fact that that ijtihad fil madhab hasn't been around for a long time. When it was recognized back then already that there's a need for tarjih, then going back to the earlier books, or for a Shafi'i faqih just to take al-Muhadhab and point out from there what is rajih in the madhab. In the Muqaddimah of Sharh al-Muhadhab, Imam Nawawi writes that any book of the madhab, be it Nihaya of Imam al-Haramain, be it Hawiya of Mawardi, be it the books of Abu Ishaq al-Shirazi, or any of these earlier ones, fatwa cannot just be given on that particular view contained in these earlier ones, because tarjih happens at this stage, at Nawawi and Rafi'i stage. I notice also the tendency of some ulama not of the madhab to ascertain the madhab of Imam Shafi'i bil-ruju'i ila kitab al-um. They'll go back to kitab al-um and say, well, this is in kitab al-um, so this is Imam Shafi'i's view. That, as far as the qawaid of the madhab is concerned, that is not correct. The Shafi'is would respond to it by saying that is what Imam Shafi'i had stated at one point. There's quite a possibility that he stated something else somewhere else. Sometimes it's also the situation that he states something else, not somewhere else, is not documented anywhere, but is transmitted orally by his students thereafter. So, Ahlul Bayt Adra Bima Fi, just going to Mukhtasar al-Muzani or Kitab al-Umm, and ascertaining the Madhab Imam Shafi'i from there, is, as far as the Qawaid of the Madhab is concerned, not quite spot on. So Imam Nawawi rahimahullah, he then takes the Muhadhab of Abu Ishaq al-Shirazi and writes a sharh upon it, Kitabun law kammalahu lakana min ahsanil kutub. But اخترمته المنية. He passed away before he could complete the book. Before he could complete the book, he passed away, but his student Alauddin ibn al-Attar, he instructs him, what happens now is that, okay, he writes the Sharh al-Muhaddab. He would have completed it had he lived longer, but at the age of over 45, Allah Ta'ala takes him away from this world. And he leaves instructions to his student Ibn al-Attar, writes on a piece of paper, these are the books that I use, someone should complete it after me. The one that takes up that particular task afterwards, Imam Subki rahimahullah, Taqiyuddin Subki. But the difference between Subki and Nawawi was that Imam Nawawi was a mudarris and a musannif and nothing else. Imam Subki was not just a qadi, he was a qadi al-qudat. He was a qadi al-qudat, he had very little time for anything else but qada. So, in addition to that, where Imam Nawawi used a method of writing that was not too long, not too short, but placed right in the middle between itnab and ikhtisar, Imam Subki's ilm was so great that some 20 pages of matn he read through three volumes of sharhan. And that's the bab of mu'amalat that he was writing on. So anyone writing at that level, he's never going to complete it, especially if he's a qadi. So he just, when, of the first printed edition, the 20-volume edition of the Sharh al-Muhaddab, Nawawi wrote about 9, Subki added about 3. And the book remained incomplete. It remained incomplete for many, many years, until in recent times, Sheikh Najib Muti'i attempted to complete it. He did a completion of it, but not nearly close to the level that Imam Nawawi rahimahullah had intended and the level that he had left us with. Someone else also, a group of scholars under the leadership of names which you might have seen very often appearing on covers, especially of the Al-Kutub Al-Ilmiyyah, Ahmad Abdul Mawjood and Ali Mu'awad, they also attempted a completion of the book recently published by the Al-Kutub Al-Ilmiyyah. Again, an attempt, but وَلَيْسَ الثُّرَيَّا كَثَّرَى. There's a vast difference between the two. These are attempts, noble attempts, but not quite on the mark. Anyway, the madhab has now been standardized, where in the 7th century already, tarjih had been given fairly just about every view. So now the Shafi'is know exactly where they stand. The need for tarjih at that time was that the Shafi'i madhab was the madhab of qada under the dawla of the Salajiqa, the Saljuqs, and as well as under the Ayyubids, and thereafter under the Mamluks. So when a madhab is in qada, that's when the need for standardization exists. And they perform that particular task. So for the next few centuries, the madhab of qada under the Ayyubids, the madhab of qada under the Mamluks will remain the Shafi'i madhab, and development of the madhab will continue thereafter. It's not to say that all the all the questions have been answered. By and large, many questions have been answered, but the agrarian world can still throw up a question or two. That is left now to the generations of fuqaha after Imam Nawawi rahimahullah. People of the caliber of Najmuddin ibn Rifa, his student Taqiyuddin al-Subki, his student and his son of course, Tajuddin al-Subki, people of the caliber of Sirajuddin Bulqini, Jamaluddin Isnawi, Shihabuddin al-Adra'i, Ibn al-Imad, Badruddin al-Zarkashi, these people continue the development of the madhab afterwards. They have what the Shaykhain, that's Nawawi and Rafi'i. Speak about the Shaykhain, in the Shafi'i madhab is going to be Nawawi Rafi'i. So what the Shaykhain have left us with, they say that's well in its place, but they will object sometimes to some tarjihat of Nawawi and Rafi'i. Sometimes they say, this is not Nawawi says, but I don't think it's right. Particular mention here must be made of Imam Isnawi, Isnawi's Muhimmat, and another book of his called Jawahir al-Bahrain. The Muhimmat has now been published, Jawahir al-Bahrain still unpublished. But it's basically a book in which he objects to the tarjihat of the Shaykhain. When the Shaykhain made tarjih, they were basically employing two principles. Two principles, Isnawi was focusing on the one principle only, and that principle is, which of the two qawls, or which of the two wajhs was preferred by the majority of the Ashabul Wujuh. If you have five people on the one side saying something, and one person on the other side, then tarjih would go with the aktariyah. Where the majority goes, that's where tarjih would go, says Isnawi. Shaykhain agree to a certain extent, but they say there's another criterion of tarjih, and that is quwwatul dalil. So if there's five people on one side, and one on the other side, but the dalil is strong on the side of the one, that's where tarjih would go. So all of these figures whose names I have mentioned, and their particular works which I have not mentioned, all of these people, they add to the madhab, and they add to this rich tapestry, which is the Shafi'i madhab during this particular period, sometimes objecting, most of the times agreeing to the tarjihat of the Shaykhain. The rule of tarjih is, if the mutaakhirin ani Shaykhain, the people of the, this will be the 7th and the 8th and the 9th century, when all of them together agree by consensus among themselves that Nawawi and Rafi'i were mistaken, then we will overrule the Shaykhain. But if one or two say the Shaykhain are wrong, and the rest of them say they are right, then the Shaykhain's view still stands. So you might find, for example, sometimes Shaykhain states something. That something might be, let's use the very common example which comes up all the time. The Shaykhain state that the shaving of the beard is makruh and not haram. A number of the other fuqaha of the madhab state that it is haram and not makruh. Adra'i after the Shaykhain say that no, in Kitabul there is a text in which Imam Shafi'i states that it is haram. And on that basis, Adra'i in Qutul Muhtaj says the shaving of the beard for that reason is haram. So his tarjih now is conflicting with their tarjih. The rule is, if Adra'i and Isnawi and Zarkashi and all these other people had agreed upon that, then that would have held. But it's only Adra'i who says that. Non-specialists in the madhab would quote, and they say, see, Adra'i says this is rajih, therefore this is rajih. This misunderstanding the structure and the tarjih in the madhab. It doesn't quite work that way. The Shaykhain's view still stands as the rajih, that's upon which fatwa is given. Moving on from there. Now, what these figures of the madhab did during these centuries, 7, 8 and 9 centuries of the hijrah, they tested the tarjihat of the Shaykhain, and then they added, remember there is preservation and there is further development. So they answered new questions as well, and amongst them they would differ at times. It's natural, different people speaking, you can expect differences in answers. Amongst them they differed. When they differ, then tarjih needs to be given again. And there's no tarjih of the Shaykhain now, because the Shaykhain had been and they have left. So what needs to be done now? A new stage of tarjih needs to be introduced. A new stage of tarjih. For that particular purpose, preparation for that stage would come in Egypt amongst fuqaha such as Shaykhul Islam Zakariya al-Ansari and his student and contemporary Shihabuddin al-Ramli. They prepare the stage for what happens next. They prepare the stage, what do? In their writings, especially Shaykhul Islam Zakariya, lived for about 100 years and wrote several books. He was also Qadi al-Qudat, but unlike Subki, he found a lot of time. He was very blessed in his time. And he wrote a lot of books. And in those books, he would incorporate all these views of Zarkashi and Isnawi and Adra'i and Ibn al-Imad and everyone else. And he would give tarjih as well, accordingly. He would give tarjih too. So amongst the students of Shaykhul Islam and Shihab Ramli, two figures would emerge as prominent. Shihab Ramli's son, Shamsuddin, Muhammad ibn Ahmad al-Ramli. And the other one would be the other student of the same two figures, Ibn Hajar al-Haytami. On the tarjihat of these two, on the tarjihat of these two figures, rests fatwa and qada in the madhab. Whatever the two of them regard as rajih, remember they will not overrule the tarjihat of the Shaykhain. The tarjihat of the Shaykhain is cast in stone. Anything that comes thereafter, or anything to which the Shaykhain had not given tarjih, that was some or the other left out of the catchment area that the Shaykhain had available to them. So it's possible that there could have been books of the madhab which they did not have. An example there would be the book called Al-Muqni' by Abu al-Husayn al-Juri. Now Nawawi never had access to that book, neither did Rafi'i. So there are some views in there which they did not take into consideration. But Najmuddin ibn Rifa got hold of this book, and his student Taqiyuddin Subki thereafter used this book as well and brought views into the madhab. The books of the people of this particular period here, after the Shaykhain up to Ramli and Ibn Hajar, the books of that particular period generally have not been published yet. It's only recently that we saw the publication of the Muhimmat of Isnawi, we saw the publication of Kifayatun Nabi, Sharhut Tanbih by Najmuddin ibn Rifa. I have heard of efforts to print Qutul Muhtaj, but the muhakkik to it was handed, eventually found it too difficult a task and just abandoned the task. But there is a move afoot to get these books published. And if they become published, inshallah it will be very beneficial to have access to them. But in any event, whatever was in them was taken up by the second stage of tarjih, when the shuruh, when the major commentaries on the minhaj were written. These commentaries are Tuhfatul Muhtaj of Ibn Hajar al-Haytami, Nihayat al-Muhtaj of Shamsuddin Ramli, Mughni al-Muhtaj of Al-Khatib al-Shirbini, and then Shaykh al-Islam Zakariya's own commentary, not on the Minhaj, but what he did to the Minhaj is that he abridged it into another book called Manhaj al-Tulab. And Manhaj al-Tulab, on that he eventually wrote a sharh called Fath al-Wahhab. So in an indirect sense, it's also a commentary of the Minhaj. So these are the major books. We could perhaps add to that the sharh of Jalal al-Mahalli. Mahalli sharh tends to be a very, very popular one in Egypt, in South India, for that matter in Malaysia, Indonesia. Personally, I do not approve of it. don't approve of it, but it's not the book that I would teach from. The reason being that it does not include the tarjihat of the second stage. He died in the 800s. He is before the next tarjih. The next tarjih came at the hands of Ramli and Ibn Hajar. So the student who wants to have access to that has to read lower down. He has to read one of these three commentaries. Either Tuhfa or Nihaya or Mughni al-Muhtaj. Mughni al-Muhtaj being the easier one amongst them. Now, Ramli and Ibn Hajar to a great extent agree. Most of the times they are in agreement. There are about 1,500 masail on which they do not agree. So what happens now? When there are masail on which they do not agree, then for a initial period, there was a regional tarjih. Ramli's students were mostly Egyptians. Ramli lived and died in Egypt. So his students were mostly Egyptians, and because the teacher was an Egyptian, the students are Egyptians, they generally used to follow the tarjihat of Ramli. In Egypt, that used to be the case. Ibn Hajar settled in Hijaz. He lived and taught in Hijaz. And in Hijaz, his students came from everywhere. There were the Yemenis, there were the Shamis, there were the Dagestanis, there were the Akrad, and people from all the various areas, up to India. Zainuddin Malibari came from India to study with him. And his tarjihat spread over those particular areas. That was initially. Then what happened was that in the next generation, people like Nuruddin, Ziyadi and others, the students of Ramli came to live in Hijaz as well. They also made hijrah and came to live in Hijaz. And they started teaching the tarjihat of Ramli side by side with the tarjihat of Ibn Hajar. And now, as Sheikh Sa'id Sumbul used to say, that man sha'a qara'a li warsh, wa man sha'a qara'a li qalun. You want to read for Warsh, you can read for Warsh. You want to read for Qalun, you can read for Qalun. Meaning that you want to go according to Ramli's Tarjihat, that's your choice. You want to go according to the Tarjihat of Ibn Hajar, that's your choice as well. So there was an open choice given between the two. There's no standard Tarjih. However, before we come to the open choice, there's something else to it. The real standard of Tarjih is this. إِن كَانَ الْمُفْتِي مِنْ أَهْلِ النَّظَرِ أَفْتَى بِمَا أَدَّى إِلَيْهِ نَظَرُهُ. If the Mufti has the independence of mind to ascertain that between the view of Ibn Hajar and Ramli, which one has a stronger dalil, he should follow his own particular tarjih between the two. If he is not, لَمْ يَكُمْ مِنْ أَهْلِ النَّظَرِ فَهُوَ مُخَيَّرٌ بَيْنَهُمَا. Now you can give tarjih whichever way you wish. Normally tarjih, standardization, comes about for the purposes of qada and iftah, especially qada. So that you have a fairly standard and predictable system of qada. The qadi cannot just do what he wants to. He should do what the book says. So why at this point did they not standardize that tarjih? I believe, wallahu alam, it's on account of the fact that the Shafi'i madhab was no longer the madhab of qada. This was the 900s, just going over the millennium into the year 1000, and a significant development had taken place by then. By the first decade of the 10th century, just after the year 900, a significant development had taken place. Sultan Salim, the Ottoman, had conquered Egypt, had conquered Syria, and the Ottoman Empire became the madhab of qada, or rather the Hanafi madhab became the madhab of qada under the Ottoman Empire. So the Shafi'i madhab wasn't removed from qada. It used to be believed that the Shafi'i madhab never really retained any kind of qada ever thereafter. More recent research shows that no. In South Yemen, in Hadramaut, there were two states, the Dawla Qu'aytiyah and the Dawla Kathiriya, the Kathirid state and the Qu'aiti state, and the Hadrami Fuqaha of Yemen maintained the tradition of Qada that continued until very recently, up until the time more or less when South Yemen became communist. And so that particular tradition of Qada continued there. For the rest of the Shafi'i world, however, there was no Qada. Egypt, there was no Shafi'i Qada. Syria, there was no Shafi'i Qada. So they settled back into a more lenient, a more lax approach to the madhab. Whoever wants to give fatwa according to Ramli, you follow Ramli. You want to give Ibn Hajar, you give Ibn Hajar. No problem. There are a number of books that document the ikhtilafat between Ramli and Ibn Hajar. Most of them are restricted only to the bab of ibadat. Only the bab of ibadat, one of them being a book called Ithmidul Aynain fi Ikhtilafi Shaykhain by Sheikh Ali Ba Sabrain. And he's taken the book of his teacher, Bushra al-Kareem fi Sharh Masail al-Ta'lim, by Muhammad Sa'id Ba'ishan. And in that book, he picked out the places where there's ikhtilaf between Ramli and Hajar, and wrote a book just documenting them all. Only restricted to the bab of the Rub' of Ibadat, because Masail al-Ta'lim, which is basically a sharh of the Muqaddim Hadramiyya, it only restricts itself to Ibadat. There's another one called Fathul Ali, Bayn ibn Hajar wa ibn al-Ramli, by a young Hadrami faqih, I forget his name, but he's of the Bafaqi family. He was only about 21 years old when he wrote this book. It's called Fathul Ali fi al-Ikhtilaf bayna Ibn Hajar wa Ramli, recently published by Darul Minhaj, edited by the daughter of Dr. Muhammad Hassan Hito, Dr. Shifa bint Muhammad Hassan Hito. This book also is restricted only to the Ruba' of Ibadat, but much more voluminous than the other one because the editor had added a copious amount of notes to the book as well. But the best one of this the best book in this genre of literature would be the book by Sheikh Omar Al-Qaradaghi. Omar Qaradaghi is a Kurdi faqih, lived something like 100 years ago, and he wrote a book published now by Darul Bashair. It's called Al-Manhalun Naddakh fi Ikhtilaf Al-Ashiyakh. And in that book, bab by bab, from the bab of Miyah up to Bay' Ummahat al-Awlad, the entire spectrum of fiqh, he documents the ikhtilafat between Ibn Hajar and Ramli and Khatib Shirbini and Shaykh al-Islam. Mostly restricting to the first two, often bringing in Khatib Shirbini, now and then Shaykh al-Islam will feature as well. So there you have a ready list of all those ikhtilafat. What does the mufti do? إِنْ كَانَ مِنْ أَهْلِ النَّظَرْ أَفْتَى بِمَا أَدَّى إِلَيْ نَظَرُهُ وَإِلَّا أَفْتَى بِأَيِّهَا شَاءَ. The final kinds of books that set out the qawaid of tarjih and iftah in the madhab, the first of those would be a book by Muhammad ibn Sulaiman al-Kurdi. It's called Al-Fawaid al-Madaniyah. Al-Fawaid al-Madaniyah fi man yufta biqawlihi min mutaakhiri al-Shafi'iyah. Fawaid al-Madaniyah was thereafter abridged by an Indian scholar. This Indian scholar, Ahmad Koya al-Malibari, he called it Al-Awaid al-Diniyah. في اختصار الفوائد المدنية. Aside from that one, there's another one by a later scholar Alawi, Ibn Ahmad al-Saqqaf. He called his book الفوائد المكية فيما يحتاجه طلبة الشافعية, which he abridged himself. It's called the Mukhtasar of the Fawaid Makkiyah. These are the books that contain basically the qawaid of tarjih within the madhab, and that's a bit of a structure of the madhab that I promised to speak to you about. Aside from that, two other aspects remain. Furu, usul, and qawaid. Okay, furu is something that's basically the content of fiqh. By and large, that's the content of fiqh. That's what the fiqh books would be filled with. However, aside from furu, there's also the usul. One of the difficulties that we face in the field of usul is that the books in usul tend to be written in a very convoluted, complicated, difficult way. One Mawlana asked me a question once, and he says that, do you know why we study usul? I say, yufiduna fadilatu sheikh. So fadilatu sheikh says, we study usul in order to understand that we can never understand usul. Well, that kind of defeatist attitude, I don't think Imam Shafi and all the other great usuliyin that came after him had intended that that should be the purpose of usul. The purpose of usul is something a bit more nobler than that. But it is a fact that the standard books of usul, they leave a lot to be desired, not in terms of the content. The content is 100%, but in the sense of accessibility and understandability. A Kurdi alim says that I taught Jam'ul Jawami' with the Sharh of Mahalli for 40 years, and there's still places that I don't understand. It's not because there's something wrong with the subject. Sometimes it's something to do with the manner of presentation. And there are certain things that crept into usul from elsewhere, maybe from the field of usul al-deen, and it overlaps with usul al-fiqh, so there tend to be some kalami masail, some philosophical issues in there as well. But the fact that there are difficult parts, is not a walk in the park. Usul is a demanding subject, but not demanding to the extent that we have to adopt the kind of defeatist attitude which we spoke of earlier. So, Imam Shafi rahmatullah alayhi was the pioneer of writing his fiqh in terms of his usul. Writing the usul separately, writing the usul separately, and connecting the two in a particular way that you can see there's a thread of logic, there's a thread of legal theory that runs through it all. In the case of the other madhahib, often they had to rediscover the usul from the furu left by the imams. In the case of the Shafi'i madhab, the bulk of it is contained in the Risalah. Yes, there are certain cases where the Shafi'is also have to resort to the same kind of thing of rediscovering the usul by a reference to the furu that they had left behind. But the main body of usul is that particular body left in the Risalah, thereafter developed by the commentaries in the Risalah, by Abu Bakr al-Sayrafi and Abu Muhammad al-Juwayni and so many others, and eventually flowering into the books of Ghazali and Imam al-Haramain and Fakhruddin Razi and the Mukhtasarat and the Shuruh that came thereafter. In the present day and age, we're living in an era where What has happened is that the world has become revolutionized. It's no longer the same agrarian world of yesterday. For 1,000 years and more, 1,100, 1,200, 1,200 years perhaps, for 1,200 years, the development, the steady development of fiqh, eventually gave us a legacy that fairly well covers all the possible scenarios that could arise in an agrarian world. So there was no need for writing new works. All that would be done now, if there's a matn, we write a sharh on it. If there's a sharh, a person will write a hashia on it. If there's a hashia, write a taqreer on it. If there's a taqreer is already in place, you have nothing else to do. You teach it. This was the age that many call the age of, what do they call it now, stagnation of fiqh. I take issue with that. It's not an age of stagnation. It is an age in which fiqh came to its maturity. But the world in which Muslims lived at that time was not an industrialized world yet. That was before the coming of the colonialists. When the colonialists left us, when they came to us, remember, they coming from industrialized Europe. We are still agrarian world of Islam. When they left us, they left the imprints of an industrialized world upon an agrarian world, and suddenly we found that we are leagues behind them. Leagues behind them because suddenly they gave us factories, they gave us banks, they gave us technology, they gave us all of these things, and we had not had adequate time to catch up with it as yet. And therefore, the backlog was so huge that it was imagined that fiqh doesn't have the answers. Why? Because fiqh, according to madhahib, who's responsible for this? The madhahib are responsible. They caused fiqh to stagnate. I don't think that was the case. The fiqh was mature. The fiqh had become comprehensive, covering everything but for an agrarian world. And if the world will remain an agrarian world, then those answers that are contained in there will be fairly sufficient. But the world is not an agrarian world any longer. The sciences have developed, finances have developed, economies have developed, just about everything has developed, and in the meantime, morals have taken a huge dip. So the society is no longer that exemplary society yesterday, which is simple in terms of its economy, simple in terms of all the various dynamics in operation in society. So who got to be blamed? Madhahib got to be blamed, and a new tendency started. We need to get away from Madhahib. We need to get away from Madhahib. We need to open the doors of Ijtihad again, because those fuqaha who don't want to make Ijtihad, it's on account of them that we can't answer the problems of the day. Dr. Muhammad Saeed Ramadan Al-Buthi speaks about this in a book that in which he says, this tendency to want to go back to the root, reinvent Ijtihad all over again, and open the doors of Ijtihad to solve the problems of the modern world. He says this is marhala zamaniya mubaraka, la madhab fiqhi. It's not a madhab. The idea of going back to source is a wonderful one, but it's not a madhab fiqhi, it's an age of awakening. Marhala zamaniya mubaraka. There's blessing in it, because it calls for us to wake up and smell this particular coffee, that there are new problems. And the new problems cannot simply be solved by reference to Tuhfa and Nihaya. It cannot be solved by Rawda and Sharh al-Muhadhab alone. There needs to be some originality here. New world will require new problems. But the new problems do not always require very, very completely original, unprecedented Ijtihad. If I look at the works, at the work of the various majami' fiqhiyya, we have this phenomenon in the modern world of what they call Ijtihad Jama'i. Instead of one person doing it, they call a huge conference, call all our scholars together, and they would sit on it, and they would deliberate, and they would give a kind of a resolution thereafter. The resolution is really based upon research papers that have been written and delivered in those particular academies. And if I look at the kind of thought that goes into that, it's not your wild, unprecedented, unchained Ijtihad, completely going back to Kitab and Sunnah only. It is filled with copious references to the Madahib. Copious reference to the Madahib, sometimes the Arba'ah, sometimes even the non-Arba'ah, but completely, unchained Ijtihad, complete free Ijtihad as such. Having that kind of Ijtihad is, in a certain sense, a little bit of a pipe dream. Because when the wheel exists, you don't need to reinvent it. So when the wheel exists in actuality in front of us, the mas'ala in front of us is one, you know, fulan touched his wife, does his wudu break? That wheel has been invented already, we don't need to reinvent it. But if a new mas'ala comes up, and that is that I buy normally from the shop, what if I buy from a vending machine? Well, the vending machine doesn't exist in the books of fiqh. But the general rules of ta'aqud The shurut of an aqd, they do exist over there. We take it from there and we apply it to the new situation. Buying over the internet, etc. It didn't quite happen because you always had a human figure on the other side. The world of finances and economics, extremely evolutionized. But what exists within the fiqh in terms of its potential, not always the actuality, but in terms of its potential, can very easily be extended. And that's what I see what many of the majami', the participants in the majami' fiqh here has done. There is a bit of a difference though, in that there is generally no taqayyud bi madhab mu'ayyan in this particular regard. They do not restrict themselves and say that I will only take him from the view of a particular madhab. Some would, many would not. For which reason? Reasons might abound. Some might feel that the answers to the problem are not to be found within one madhab alone. The answers could be found elsewhere as well. And others would find, well, others would feel that this is the madhab. This madhab produces a consistent set of answers. So we will say that by extending what exists into what doesn't exist yet, by extrapolation from the existing legacy to answer contemporary problems, thereby we have not only produced an answer, but we have perpetuated a certain legacy as well. By extending the logic, for example, of the Shafi'i madhab to the situations of today, the madhab itself becomes sustained. It perpetuates itself in that particular manner. What would be required for any such extrapolation and extension and sustaining of the madhab in this particular way, though, is not just knowing out of the furu'. Beyond it, one needs to have a solid knowledge of usul as well. Beyond it, one needs to have a very good knowledge of qawaid fiqhiyah and all the related subjects to it. Qawaid fiqhiyah is generally placed historically somewhere in the 6th or 7th century when they started writing about it. But a few years ago, a group of colleagues and I, we were in Egypt and we decided for the sake of Tabarruk, we will take one of Imam Shafi'i's books, one of his books, one of the shorter ones, and we will read half of it in the Masjid of Amr ibn al-As, where Imam Shafi'i used to sit and teach, and half of it next to the qabr of Imam Shafi'i. So we selected one of the shortest ones, it's called Jima'ul Ilm. And as we're reading through Jima'ul Ilm, the first half at Amr ibn al-As, the second half next to the qabr. And sitting there, I come to realize that Jima'ul Ilm, the second half, is actually a book on Qawaid Fiqhiyah. It's foreshadowing the discipline of Qawaid Fiqhiyah that would take shape so many years later on. There are a lot of hidden things within these particular smaller constituent books of Kitabul Umm that still need to be mined for the fawaid that they will hold. So the development of Qawaid Fiqhiyah, which is the overarching tendencies of fiqh, things such as what? They speak about the five general qawaid that cover fiqh. خَمْسٌ مُحَرَّرَةٌ قَوَاعِدُ مَذْهَبٍ لِلشَّافِعِيِّ بِهَا تَكُونُ خَبِيرًا ضَرَرٌ يُزَالُ وَعَادَةٌ قَدْ حُكِّمَتْ وَأَنَّ الْمَشَقَّةَ تَجْلِبُ التَّيْسِيرًا وَالشَّكُّ لَا تَرْفَعْ بِهِ مُتَيَقَّنًا وَالنِّيَّةَ أَخْلِصْ إِذَا أَرَدْتَ أُجُورًا. These five qawaid, you can reduce all of it down to these five. Then there are some other qawaid which are not as general as these, but have a certain limited application. And then there's the fun of istithna, and the fun of furuq, and the fun of so many different things that have been developed by the fuqaha over these years. These are disciplines within the larger tradition of fiqh, which generally we do not access. We generally do not access them because we might restrict ourselves to reading certain mutun, thereafter maybe reading a sharh or two. I believe that if the intention is to create create tafaqquh within the student, fiqhi ability within the student, then the material that's presented to the student must be presented in a way of tafqih that will create fiqhi ability in him. So to remain with the small mutun, Safinatun Naja, Muqaddima Hadramiyya, for that matter, Umdatu Salik even, it will not create fiqhi ability. It creates ma'rifatu masailil madhab, but it does not create tafaqquh. That kind of tafaqquh is going to have to come from elsewhere. Imam Taqiyuddin Subki in his fatwa was asked about this question about hifdhul mutun. Many people prefer the ancient method of making hifdh of the matn. And he says hifdh of mutun is not ilm. It's a skill, but it's not ilm. It's a skill. Having memorized the matn, now you actually start studying thereafter. If hifdh of the matn was fiqh, then every hafidh of the Quran is a mufassir. But it doesn't happen. So while there's something to set for hifdh, thereafter that book needs to be studied in detail. It needs to be studied in detail, then comes the type of book. Which book are you going to study? Towards the latter period in Egypt, they became very partial towards Mahalli and to a certain extent Fathul Wahab of Shaykhul Islam as well. And around these books, many Hawashi were written, and those are useful Hawashi. The problem with Fathul Wahab, Sharh Manhaj al-Tullab, is that it restricts itself only to the Rajih in the Madhab. The marjuhat. So for the sake of amal, for the sake of qada, for the sake of iftah, it's wonderful. But for the sake of tafqih, it doesn't quite fulfill the desired role. So I believe that one needs to go back to the minhaj again. One needs to go back to the minhaj. One step back, you need to be aware of the marjuhat of the madhab as well. Because one of the peculiarities of our madhab is that the marjuh definitely does play a role. The marjuh is not completely abandoned and dismissed. The fuqaha of our madhab rule that for purposes of qada and iftah, you restrict yourself to the rajih fil madhab only. But it comes to amalun nafs. When you make amal for yourself, you can even practice the marjuh as long as it is not of that kind which is a complete, based on a complete fasid dalil. And how do you determine when it's based upon the fasid dalil? You can determine it very easily from the minhaj when Imam Nawawi uses the word as-sahih or he uses the word al-mashhur. Then the opposite will be a view whose dalil is generally fasid. Otherwise, if he uses the word asah, then the opposite is still based upon a considerably strong dalil. And if he uses the word adhar, then the opposite qawl will still have some kind of strength in terms of dalil. So, they say that for amalun nafs, you can practice upon the marjuhat. Can you inform others of that particular marjuh? Generally, people will be practicing the rajih. They will say that, well, man touched a woman, husband touched his wife, the wudu will break. There are other views in the madhab as well. Aqwal of Imam Shafi'i, ikhtiarat of his ashab thereafter. Can they practice upon those particular views? The person who's being asked by that ammi, you know, what do I do in a case such as this? You must read the situation first. Don't open up the doors of marjuhat to everyone wide, all and sundry can just come. No, read the situation. When the situation produces compelling reasons for opening the door to marjuhat, then it could be done. Otherwise, chaos will ensue. However, they do not call that iftar. Once you inform the person that this is the rajih of the madhab, that's iftar. But if you inform this is a marjuh, that's not called iftah, they have a different term for it. They call that irshad. Irshad to distinguish it from iftah. Because in iftah you have to present the madhab. But what you need to be clear about in a case like that is that you need to inform the person first that the madhab, the rajih view of the madhab is X. But your situation demands some lenience and therefore there's an alternative opinion and that is why. Don't just present the alternative opinion first glance. First state the rajih because that is amana ilmiyah. You're being asked about the madhab, iftan, mention that view. And then for the sake of tasheel, for the sake of tasamuh, then you can mention if the situation demands it, some kind of alternative opinion. There's another thing in the madhab called ikhtiyar. I mentioned the word now, so it came to mind. Ikhtiyar. And ikhtiyar is not a qawl, it's not a wajh. In other words, it's not something that Imam Shafi rahmatullahi alayhi stated, it's not something which the ashabul wujud stated as being part of the madhab. Rather, there are mujtahideen in the madhab, and there have been, for most of its history, for most of its history, there have been mujtahideen, and these mujtahideen at times develop their own independent views away from the madhab, completely away from the madhab, not using the qawaid of the adillah of the madhab, applying their own independent reasoning, complete separate case of ijtihad. Shahwaliullah writes about this, and he says that the Shafi'i madhab has produced more mujtahideen, more usuliyin, more mufassireen, more muhaddithin than any other madhab. He says this is the madhab of ijtihad mutlaq. The madhab of the Shafi'i is the madhab of ijtihad mutlaq. And we take pride in the fact that it is at the hands of the Shafi'i fuqaha of Madina Munawwara in the persons of Sheikh Ibrahim ibn Hassan al-Kurdi and his son Abu Tahir al-Kurdi that Ahmad ibn Abdul Rahim al-Dihlawi became Shah Waliullah, who the world knows today. He came to Hijaz as a normal student from India. He came to study the hadith books with them and he was very, very deeply influenced by the writings of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Kurdi. Much of what's in his writings reflect the ideas of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Kurdi as well. As a matter of interest, Sheikh Ibrahim Kurdi is also the Sheikh and the Ustad of Sheikh Yusuf who lies buried, or Sheikh Yusuf Makassa who lies buried in Cape Town. So these two traditions meet there, our tradition of ilm and the tradition of Islam in South Africa. All of them stem from the school of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Kurdi al-Qurani. And he had a great influence, Shah Waliullah. Shah Waliullah used to call himself and he used to describe himself. He says, Al-Hanafiyu madhaban, Al-Hanafiyu wa-Shafi'iyu tadrisan. In the manner that he used to teach, he used to combine both of these together because he had studied the Shafi'i madhab with the Shafi'i fuqaha in Hijaz. He had received his ijazah in hadith from that very same Shafi'i fuqaha, and our isnad of hadith that runs through Shah Waliullah invariably. Shah Waliullah had another isnad before coming to Hijaz. He used to transmit Sahih al-Bukhari from Haji Muhammad Afzal Sialkoti. But that's a isnad that has barely anyone mentions it today. When they mention Shah Waliullah's isnad, then what does it go? Shah Waliullah, from Shah Waliullah up to Hafiz ibn Hajar, the isnad goes as follows. Shah Waliullah from Abu Tahir Kurdi, from Ibrahim Kurdi, from Ahmad al-Qushashi, from Ahmad al-Shinnawi, from Shams Ramli, from Shaykh al-Islam Zakariya, from Hafiz ibn Hajar. Shafi'iyyah an akhirihim. Each one of them is a Shafi'i. This is the way in which madhahib have interacted with one another. They have interacted with one another and they've taken the best of what is to be gained. Imam Shafi'i being the first one to have laid the foundations. He took what was best in the Maliki madhab. He took what was best in the Hanafi madhab and created this particular synthesis. And from time to time this kind of borrowing will happen because all of us are what? Ikhwanan inshallah ala sururin mutaqabilin. Drawing from one another at times when one particular tradition goes a bit low, then many of us have studied where in the madaris of the Hanafiya. The ilmi tradition in this country of ours was sustained by which? By the Darul Ulooms. Well, he says, لَنَّ أَخُذَ إِلَّا مَنْ وَجَدْنَا مَتَاعَنَا عِنْدَهُ. I was asked to speak as with regard to our curriculum at our madrasa. Yes, there was quite a bit of soul searching to do when we decided to have a madrasa and to have a curriculum. I remember in those days, Mon Abdul Hamid, Hafidhahullah, called me at the time and asked me to come and teach at Darul Mazadville. And I thanked Maulana for the opportunity, but I i'tadartu. And I said that what I feel is needed really is not just a Hanafi madrasa with a Shafi'i window. It won't quite, do the job. It won't do the trick. What you need is a madrasa that is Shafi'i from beginning up to end.